Hello, I'm Mike Dacry. This is number 0145, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0145. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Gordon R. Freeman, author of Hidden Stonehenge. 30 years ago, Gordon discovered an ancient sun temple in southern Alberta.
On the prairies, they couldn't occupy it for a lot of the time because it was covered with ice. But the ice slid back 10,000 years ago, and the prairie's been pretty much like it is now for 8,000 years. And 5,200 years ago, the people built a calendar that's more accurate than the one I use.
Dr. Shirley Impelizzeri is the author of Why Can't I Change? How to Conquer Your Self-Destructive Patterns.
In the last 10 years, there's been a lot of research on the brain, and we found out that we can change our brain. It's not easy, but we can definitely do it.
Stuart Nolman is in with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nolman, and this time Book Banter has the right prescription with Dr. Sanjay Gupta's first novel, Monday Mornings, along with a couple of other medical works of fiction. So pick up your stethoscope. It's soon time for rounds on the Stuff File program.
And we have lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0145, was Mike Dacry, who is a radio and TV account executive and publicist for Newman Communications. And they've been very helpful over the years in helping to put this program together. So thank you very much, Mike, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program. And yes, the Stuff File program can also be heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Well, New Hampshire State Police say the incident began when one driver cut off another as they were going through a toll plaza in Hooksett. I believe there was a gesture between the two of them, notes Sergeant Charles Johnson. Then investigators say Nicholas Richer, age 18, pulled out a flare gun, pointed it at the other driver, and fired. But the gun didn't go off until he pulled the gun back into his car. The flare ended up inside his own car and caught the right passenger's front seat on fire. A passenger, yes, there was actually somebody sitting in that front seat, only described as a youth, was sitting in that seat and narrowly missed being hit. The other driver called 911, and a state trooper caught up with Richer at a gas station. Richer was arrested and charged with reckless conduct and criminal threatening, which are both felonies. While I'm sure the youth in the passenger seat was offered a change of pants. Anyway, anybody who listens to this show regularly knows how I feel about cats. They're evil. Little pieces of evil plotting to overthrow mankind. A man from southern Israel divorced his wife this week because she had brought 550 cats into their home. The husband, apparently not a cat lover, told the rabbinical court in Beersheba that he was unable to sleep in his bedroom because the surface of the marital bed was constantly covered with cats who refused to lie on the floor. The man, in his divorce request, complained that the cats also blocked his access to the bathroom and did not allow him to prepare meals in the kitchen. When he sat to eat, cats jumped on the table and stole his food. The couple attempted reconciliation at the behest of the rabbinical court. The wife, however, was unable to part with her cats and preferred to part with her husband. 550 cats. Yeah, she would have lost me at one. Anyway, moving right along, firefighters were called to the Middletown, Connecticut High School. A fire detector went off in the boys' locker room. Quick investigation found that there was no fire. It was some kid in the locker room using body spray, and it created a cloud of mist right underneath the sensor, according to the fire marshal. It looks like he used an overabundance, said the fire marshal. Also, he added, they said it was Axe body spray. Well, at least Axe is something a firefighter can identify with. And we've all seen the commercials, haven't we? And obviously, so did that kid. In Ferndale, California, 40-year-old John Vincente will stand trial for assault and resisting police after he allegedly turned violent when his fiancée kissed another woman. A neighbor called police after hearing loud fighting next door. Police say they arrived and found the suspect's fiancé and another couple who had earlier been celebrating the fiancé's birthday along with Vincente. Police said the other couple and the fiancé were highly intoxicated. Ferndale Police Sergeant Patrick Jones said the fiancé was bleeding from her lower lip and the other man had severe lacerations on his forehead and face. The other woman told us that she and her boyfriend had been celebrating with the suspect and his fiancé, and Vincente became upset because the two women kissed at one point. Witnesses told police Vincente began punching his fiancé, and the other woman grabbed a frying pan and hit the suspect in the head. Yeah. That was before he took it away and used it to strike her 38-year-old boyfriend. Yeah. The inside of the house was trashed, and officers said they had to struggle with Vincente before arresting him in a nearby neighbor's yard. Okay, Katy Perry, see what you've caused. And I'm also going out on a limb and assuming that Vincente voted yes for Prop 8 in California. I'm just guessing. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News with me, Peter Anthony Holder, before we get to our first guest, a 61-year-old German woman got fed up with the constant stream of telemarketing calls to her home, so she finally set out to get some revenge. On the next call, she blew a whistle as loud as she could down the phone. But hold on, before you start applauding and try it yourself, the call center employee, a woman, suffered hearing problems and tinnitus as a result. And the whistleblower ended up in a court convicted of causing bodily harm and was also fined $1,000. The woman initially challenged the fine but decided to pay it shortly before an appeal hearing was due to be heard. Yeah, what I would like to know is, wow, the Germans don't have a do not call list? Really? I'm shocked. Anyway, on to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Gordon R. Freeman has visited archaeological sites around the world. In 1980, he discovered an ancient sun temple in southern Alberta and has studied it ever since. He's the author of Hidden Stonehenge, and he joins us on the line right now from Alberta. Hi, Gordon.
Hi.
One of the things we've always been told, when, especially if you're of a certain age and you learn history, is that Europeans discovered this place. That it ignores what the natives did before who were here, and it doesn't tell of a history that goes back for a long period of time. Talking about Hidden Stonehenge, you go back a long way.
Well, 5,200 years for top-notch science. So, I mean, they've been here for 30,000 years, but on the prairies, they couldn't occupy it for a lot of the time because it was covered with ice. But the ice slid back 10,000 years ago, and the prairie has been pretty much like it is now for 8,000 years. And 5,200 years ago, the people built a calendar that's more accurate than the one I use.
Wow. Now, when you say the people, who exactly built Sun Temple in Alberta?
Well, nobody knows that, but it was used continually. The calendar, you can measure the dates of it by the solstice, sunrise, and set lines. It's been used continuously from 5,200 years ago up to about 1,800, about 200 years ago. So for 5,000 years, people have been using it continually and adjusting the lines, and they've left stone tool offerings in the stone pile. That's the sun effigy, and there's sort of a continuous gradation in the styles of those projectile points. So there's no reason to believe that the people who built it didn't look like the Cree and the Blackfoot and the Lakota and Nakoda and so on. They're what we call Indians.
Now, as I said, and the title is Hidden Stonehenge, when we think of Stonehenge, we think of England, but this predates, if I have my numbers right, England's Stonehenge by about 800 years, and it also predates even the Egyptian pyramids.
That's right. That's right. And nobody knows why, because it's exactly the same solar and lunar calendars here and in Stonehenge, and I don't know of any other complete calendars in Egypt or any place else. Nobody knows whether people independently discovered these things or whether there was movement from here to there or what was going on. But anyway, the same calendars, both for the sun and the moon, exist here and in England. separated by an ocean and a continent.
Now this is a latter discovery as compared to the other places we are familiar with. Why was it hidden?
Well, our place is out in the middle of the prairie, and it doesn't stick up with 20-ton, 50-ton stones like Stonehenge in England. It's like a spider web spread over about 31 square kilometers of land on the rolling prairie, and it's hard to see. I mean, you've got to sort of be tuned into these places. I think that the reason it still exists is that nobody knew it was there, because the white people coming from Europe destroyed all the cultural stuff that they could get a hold of the people who lived here. I mean, this seems to be part of human nature. If you conquer a land, you try and destroy the language, all the culture of the people that you've taken over. And this calendar, thank God, it looks like just a bunch of stone piles. They didn't think it was worth destroying. So we have it.
So how was it discovered? How did you guys come across this?
Well, my father collected stone tools from the prairie in Saskatchewan during the 1930s when dry winds were blowing away tilled soil. He did that as a hobby, but much later I inherited a third of his collection, and then I started to wonder about it. So I pestered geologists and archaeologists about these types of stone and the types of tools I had. And they got tired of me because I'm kind of persistent. And then an archaeologist said, "Hey, Gord, do you know Jim McGregor?" Well, Jim McGregor was another dedicated amateur who had a fantastic collection from all over Alberta of stone tools. And so I pestered him about his fantastic collection for about a year. And he got tired of me and he said, "Hey, Gord, I'll bet you I know a bunch of places you and Phil," that's my wife, "would love to see." He drew me a map of 15 places in southern and eastern Alberta to get me out of the city for a while. So we went to see all these things, and everything he drew me and told me about seemed okay, except this one that he called the Majorville Medicine Wheel. And when we were walking up the hill to that, it's like a stone pile with a rig of stones around it, and we're on top of it. We passed all kinds of other patterns of stone that looked just as artificial as the stone pile on the top. And so I asked archaeologists when I went back, showed them pictures, and said, "What about all these other patterns?" They said, "Nah, those stones are right where the glacier dropped them 10,000 years ago. The only man-made thing is a stone pile on the top of the hill." Well, these kinds of patterns are not accidental. So we started to study. We thought we'd clean it up in 2 or 3 years. But it's 32 years later, and we're still making discoveries. I mean, it's just a fantastic place, unique in the world. Most accurate calendar I've ever seen.
Now, since your discovery of this, since your book has come out, has this drawn the attention of archaeologists and history buffs from around the world?
Well, I'm a chemical physicist, and it turns out that archaeologists protect their territory very jealously. If he were a government worker, we'd say he's covering his ass. But they don't want any information from an outsider, because it's sort of, I'm doing for free what they get paid for. And so they just say that I'm a crackpot, and they don't accept this. But I say, that's okay, because you're going to die, and your students love this stuff. So the next generation of archaeologists are going to eat this stuff up and extend what I've done.
So basically, you're at the cutting edge, the ground floor of what is a major discovery here in Canada.
That's right. It's a phenomenal place. There's nothing like it been described in this detail anywhere on Earth. It's just an amazing thing. And what it shows is that the people we call Indians got the same genius as we or the Asians or anybody else has. And because they don't speak good English, we don't recognize that genius. So as I ask in this book, how many of these genii do we actually recognize? I know one or two, but I won't name them because it would embarrass them.
Now, have you had the opportunity to talk to, band councils, First Nations, about this to maybe learn something about a history that they may have passed down and discussed, but not parallel to ours, and therefore have some of the answers to hidden Stonehenge?
Well, the white people have done so many terrible things to the Indians that they won't talk to any white person about what's really sacred to them. I mean, they won't even talk to half-breeds about what's that sacred to them. And so, because I don't press anybody, they let a little bit of stuff fall in front of me because they know that I won't pass it on. So I know that some people know, but I can't write about it, and they don't want white people to write it down, and they won't communicate with white people. So they tolerate me, and that's good enough for me, because as it says in the end of that book, in one of the sections, the young Indian said, somebody's got to write it down because we're going to die. And his uncle said, but Dad said, never tell. And his dad was one of the highest holy men of the Siksika Nation.
So what is it?
It's a conflict.
So what is it, besides the location and sharing this story, what is it you want to get out most with your book, Hidden Stonehenge?
I want to get out most is that every nation, every type of people have the same genius. We seem to get a brain with subspecies. We are Homo sapiens sapiens, which I guess is more intelligent, more brain power than the Homo sapien. But for 40,000 years, we haven't changed in intelligence one speck. We just have different philosophies. We have different toys to play with. I mean, your iPad is just a toy. The guy who made this fantastic calendar was a toy, because you don't make this kind of thing to make it useful. You make it because it's beautiful. And so I want the Indians eventually to get a lot more land than they've got now.
The book is called Hidden Stonehenge. It's written by Gordon R. Freeman. And Gordon, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to chat with us and talk about the book and the amazing discovery.
Thank you for doing this.
Gordon R. Freeman, author of Hidden Stonehenge. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0145, and you'll find links to Gordon's website. You'll also find links to Amazon.com and Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander's show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick. If you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
Q
Coming to you from Canada, the land of universal healthcare, colorful money, and the correct spelling of the word theater. This is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come in the program, we'll talk to the author of Why Can't I Change? How to Conquer Your Self-Destructive Patterns. And Stuart Nullman will be along with another edition of Book Banter. Plus, of course, there is indeed an Idiot of the Day and lots more stuff right here on the Stuff File program, which you can hear on Stitcher Smart Radio. Stitcher allows you to listen to your favorite shows directly on your iPhone, Android phone, Kindle Fire, and beyond, just about any mobile device you have. On demand and on the go. Don't have Stitcher? Well, download it for free today at Stitcher.com or at the App Store. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Got a couple of stories I want to share with you from the world of Facebook, or at least involve Facebook. Now, there's a new website called GirlfriendHire.com that caters to only the truly pathetic. For only $5, guys can hire a girlfriend to give them dating advice, send flirty texts to make their real girlfriends jealous, or they can also friend them on Facebook and write sexy things to make all their other guy friends green with envy. It's all the brainchild of a 22-year-old Edison State College student by the name of Cody Krachicki. And don't laugh, so far she's gotten over 300 orders. That's really sad. Really, really sad. Meanwhile, when Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg changed his status to married a couple of weeks ago, he promptly received over 1 million likes from his followers. Too bad he doesn't realize his site is a marriage wrecker. Okay, that might be stretching things a bit, but would you believe over one-third of all divorce filings last year in the UK contained the word Facebook, and over 80% of US divorce lawyers say that they've seen a huge rise in the number of cases using social networking, according to the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers. Gary Traceman, a divorce attorney in New London, Connecticut, says, "I see Facebook issues breaking up marriages all the time." Of the 15 cases he handles per year, where computer history, texts, and emails are admitted as evidence, 60% exclusively involve Facebook. "Affairs happen with a lightning speed on Facebook," says K. Jason Krafsky, who authored the book Facebook and Your Marriage with his wife Kelly. "In the real world," he says, "office romances and out-of-town trysts can take months or even years to develop. On Facebook," he says, "they happen in just a few clicks." Randy Kessler, an Atlanta-based lawyer and current chair of the family law section of the American Bar Association, says, "The difference with Facebook is it feels safe, innocent, and private. People put an enormous amount of incriminating stuff out there voluntarily. When couples do end up in divorce court, lawyers say Facebook posts are often used to determine alimony and child custody." Of course, in all fairness to Mr. Zuckerberg, it's not Facebook's fault. It's the people who use it. I'm guessing a lot of relationships are now listed as complicated. Anyway, here's a questionable strategy. Robert Stank, age 39, was arrested in Beaver Creek, Ohio in April and charged with trying to rob the Huntington Bank. According to police, he had approached the bank's counter but became ill and asked a teller to call 911 to summon medics. There were conflicting news reports about when medics arrived to treat Stank, but there was agreement that Stank recovered and subsequently presented the same teller his pre-written holdup note demanding cash. He was arrested in short order. You know, sometimes on the job, you really need to call in sick and take a day off. And speaking of calling in sick and taking a day off, here's our last story in this section of Stuff File News before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. It would appear the 911 system in the nation's capital leaves a bit to be desired. As a panicked woman's husband turned blue, the Montgomery County Fire and Rescue dispatcher on the other end of the line did nothing but snore, fast asleep. The woman had called for help as her husband was having trouble breathing. After the initial 911 operator transferred the call to the county fire and rescue dispatcher, all she heard on the other end of the line was snoring. Another dispatcher got on the line with the woman trying to help, but the sleeping dispatcher's snoring confused the call taker, who thought the sounds were emanating from the woman's husband. About 6 minutes into the call, the sleeping dispatcher woke up, asking the woman, "What's the address?" Montgomery County Assistant Fire Chief Scott Graham said the snoring dispatcher was immediately removed from the floor by his supervisor that night and placed on administrative leave with pay pending an inquiry. Fortunately, the patient was transported to a hospital and didn't suffer any adverse effects as a result of the call. The sleeping firefighter was reportedly 17 hours into a 24-hour overtime shift at the time of the incident. Okay, now call me madcap, but maybe the person who should be on administrative leave is the person who put this guy on a 24-hour overtime shift. That doesn't seem smart when somebody's sitting there all day taking phone calls from people. I'm sure there are times where they could easily fall asleep, but that's just me talking. That's all I'm saying. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Dr. Shirley Impelizzeri is the sex, love, and relationship expert for the brand new Cosmopolitan Latina magazine, which launched this month. She also is the author of Why Can't I Change? How to Conquer Your Self-Destructive Patterns. She's on the line with us right now from California. Hi, Shirley.
Hi.
Just by the title of the book, I'm guessing that the situation is that basically we are the masters of our own destiny, and we can change. It is up to us.
Absolutely, and included with that is we can actually change our brains. Our brain is plastic, so with focused attention, we can change it. That old idea of you can't teach an old dog new tricks is a lie.
Okay, so how do these lies that we've been living for generations, how do these lies get started?
Well, you know, we didn't have that information 20, 30 years ago, probably when that old saying came about. In the last 10 years, there's been a lot of research on the brain, and we found out that we can change our brain. It's not easy, but we can definitely do it.
Is part of the problem not necessarily what we have to think about ourselves, but how we're conditioned by those around us, for instance, our parents? In other words, parents laying their own fears onto their children, and that just perpetrates from generation to generation?
Well, you know, absolutely. And, you know, the first thing that I want to make clear on my book is it's not a blame your parents book, you know. But the reality is that we do learn a lot from our environment and who we attach to as babies and as infants. And who we attach to are the two people that are there from the beginning. You know, whether it's mom or dad or even a nanny, we're biologically programmed to attach to someone. And how sensitive that someone is to our needs sets the foundation for how our brain develops, literally, for our belief systems, and eventually for how we behave in the world.
One of the things you talk about is self-esteem, and I'm just wondering, can self-esteem be self-starting?
Well, it depends on what you mean by self-starting.
Well, we often talk about the fact that someone's self-esteem is something that is nurtured, something, again, and I don't want to get into the blame game of parents or teachers or those around us, but that self-esteem is something that's nurtured, and I'm just wondering if it's something that is inherent within us that we can develop on our own.
No, I mean, we're not born with either, you know, healthy self-esteem or lack of self-esteem. It is definitely nurtured through our environment. So as little kids, you know, again, we're biologically programmed to connect, to bond to someone for our survival. You know, the little babies that you know, crawled away in the Neanderthal times got eaten. So we are biologically programmed, innately programmed to connect to someone. So if that someone gives us attention, says kind words to us, feeds us, is sensitive to our needs, then we have this innate belief that we belong in the world and that it's a good thing that we're here. If that person ignores us, abuses us, doesn't pay attention to us, then we inherently believe that there's something wrong with us because it is much too scary to believe that there's something wrong with the person who we absolutely depend on to survive.
So how does one go about fixing that latter category you just described?
Well, you know, the first step is awareness. It's insight and awareness. You know, that alone won't help us change, but that is the necessary first step to change. Once we become aware of something, like even aware of how we were parented, you know, again, not to blame parents, but to understand the why of things, the why of who we are. Why do I think that I don't deserve someone to love me? Where did that come from? You know, then we can make different choices, because then when we meet the man or woman who doesn't treat us well, we can decide, okay, typically I would continue with this person, but now I understand this person is not treating me in the way that I should be treated, so I'm going to stop dating this person. That presents a new choice. It's not always that the behavior is easy. You know, the new choice is easy to make because we like what's familiar. But nonetheless, the awareness of where it came from allows us to have new choices.
The subtitle of your book, How to Conquer Your Self-Destructive Patterns. Even the most secure person, do they also have self-destructive patterns?
Well, you know, when you look at self-destructive patterns, that means patterns that sabotage getting what you want, whether it's at work or whether it's in a love relationship or even, you know, a quality of life in general with friends and so on. So someone who has secure attachment and who has, you know, has healthy self-esteem sometimes will make a mistake, but they'll learn from their mistakes. They won't judge themselves for making the mistake, you know. So it really depends on how we behave. It doesn't mean that people are immune. You know, people with healthy self-esteem are immune to any of this stuff. It's just how they react to it that makes all the difference in the world.
Are the biggest obstacles to our success ourselves?
Absolutely. Absolutely. But where did that come from? You know, I believe that it's so important to understand the why, or even the where did that come from, so I can change it.
When you set out to write this book, Why Can't I Change, who did you see as your primary audience or listener or readers, rather?
I think really, I mean, anybody who, you know, I had my daughter read it and she understood it. So if she got it, that's my target, that everybody can get it. Because really, it's everything that I learned in my own personal life that completely changed my life. It not only changed my life because I finally understood me. I understood the adult that I had become with my thoughts, with my belief system, with my behaviors. And it completely changed the way I practice. And I wanted this information out there. And the books that I read that had similar information sometimes were difficult to read, or, you know, because I really watered down scientific, you know, everything that I have in there is based on research and based on scientific facts, at least from what we know to this day. And I wanted to make it understandable for everybody.
Since we're talking a little bit about self-esteem, and you are a sex, love, and relationship expert, one of the things that self-esteem rears its head in, or lack thereof, is in a relationship. You often hear people say, in a romantic way, he or she completes me. Is that a misnomer? Do you really need someone to complete you, or should you be complete yourself before you try and enter into a relationship?
Well, it depends on how literal they're using that that term. You know, I think that because we are biologically programmed to connect with people, we need that connection, you know. But if I need someone to be with me in order to feel complete, that's also not very healthy. So it depends on, you know, how literally somebody is talking about that. But all studies show that connection, that being with people, increases our immune system and increases our years of life.
So getting back to changing patterns, and I know, you know, the whole book deals with this, but what would be the biggest piece of information you can give to our audience if someone feels they are constantly repeating patterns in their lives? What's the biggest or first step to correcting that?
Well, I think it's going kind of on a detective journey. You know, it's figuring out, is there a pattern, and what is the pattern? So you kind of have to go back and see what, you know, if it's in the realm of relationship or if it's in the realm of your job, your career. Going back and figuring out what exactly is the pattern, and then figuring out the why of the pattern. And the way I wrote the book is it builds on itself. So the first chapter is on attachment and how we attach and how that sets the foundation. The second chapter is how our brain developed due to our attachment, which they have found through studies that even attachment, how we attach to our primary caregivers, even has something to say about the genes that are stimulated. In other words, we can have a genetic predisposition to something, but given our attachment, that genetic predisposition can either be stimulated or not. So that's how important attachment is, and understanding how we attach.
And it is possible. It is possible for somebody to be successful in one aspect of their life, but put roadblocks in another aspect of their life. For instance, good at their job, but not in relationships, or vice versa. Correct?
Absolutely, absolutely. So the first step into that is figuring out what part of your life is not where you would like it to be. And then working backwards, figuring out why. Is there a pattern here? And what is that pattern? And then going even deeper in the why of that pattern. So then all of a sudden now you have choices. So when something presents itself, you're not on autopilot. You go, okay, how I would usually react to that is this way. How I want to react to it, given this information that I now have, is this other way. Let me choose this other way. And, of course, we all love what's familiar, so it's very hard to choose different behaviors. But that's what's going to cause the change. That's what's going to create the change.
The book is called Why Can't I Change? How to Conquer Your Self-Destructive Patterns. It's written by Dr. Shirley. You can check out her website at drshirley.com. And I thank you very much, Shirley, for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thank you so much, Peter. It's a pleasure to be here.
Dr. Shirley Impellizzeri, author of Why Can't I Change? How to Conquer Your Self-Destructive Patterns. You can visit my website at thestufffile.com. Go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0145, and you'll find links to Shirley's website. You'll also find links to Amazon.com and Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. We just announced the finalists in our annual Wacky Warning Label contest, and after 15 years, I can tell you they're just as outrageous as ever. One of the labels came on an electric razor for men. It warns, never use while sleeping. Another label was found on a travel pillow made specifically for children. You've probably seen it. It's often used in car seats and is a great product, but it actually warns, keep product away from children. Gee, that'll make it pretty hard to use. What are we to make of it when products start coming with labels that warn us not to use them for their intended purpose? Let's be fair. The explanation is that in America, warning labels not only have to protect consumers from danger, they have to protect product makers from frivolous lawsuits, too. And that can make for some pretty confusing labels. Sure, they can be pretty hilarious, but the cost of the lawsuits is no laughing matter. To see all of the labels and get the inside story, visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
Latitude 47 degrees 14 minutes north. Longitude 84 degrees 39 minutes west. Location Montreal, Canada. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And yes, the patient is in. Stuart Nauman is here with Book Banter. Hello, Stu.
Paging Dr. Holder. Go to surgery. Stat. Paging Dr. Holder.
Please turn and cough.
And you know, that stethoscope is cold, so just beware.
Yes, yes.
Why are we doing this, Peter? You know, all these medical references. I mean, while watching too much Grey's Anatomy? No. This is a book review segment. That's why. And on this edition of Book Banter, we're looking at a novel by a doctor. You know, I always enjoyed watching the NBC drama ER, its fast-paced, highly dramatic look at the people who made up the ER at Chicago's mythical County General Hospital, along with their many professional and personal triumphs and struggles. It became a highly anticipated Thursday night viewing habit for me. Now, when the show left the air in 2009 after 15 seasons, I almost felt a void. And I was going to lack my weekly taste of medical knowledge for laymen like me, not to mention a good serving of high-quality drama. That was until I started reading Dr. Sanjay Gupta's debut novel, Monday Mornings. Now, if the name sounds familiar to you, Dr. Sanjay Gupta is the resident medical expert and medical correspondent for CNN. Now, Dr. Gupta, relies on the tried-and-true principle of novel writing, which is write what you know. And he uses knowledge and background of medicine and the medical profession to come up with quite an entertaining novel that would have made medical novelists Frank G. Slaughter and Michael Crichton very proud. Now, the book mainly takes place at Chelsea General, a highly regarded teaching hospital somewhere in Michigan. There's a whole group of doctors and administrators, including Ty Wilson, the superstar-like brain surgeon, George Villanueva, the former Detroit Lions player-turned-tough-as-nails ER doctor with a strong sense of compassion for the patients that come through the doors, and as well Tina Ridgway, a doctor who prefers helping have-not patients at a local medical clinic, yet has to juggle a disabled daughter and a crumbling marriage to boot, and that's amongst the other characters in the book. Now, the common bond that these men and women in white have as part of their professional life at Chelsea General is when their pagers ring with the message 311.6, and that's not a temperature. That means that the dreaded the morbidity and mortality, or M&M meeting, which takes place in room 311 of the hospital on certain Monday mornings promptly at 6 a.m. Now, these meetings are an inquisition-like gathering of the hospital surgeons and administrators, and when a certain case goes wrong, the doctors in question have to face their peers and answer a series of hard, withering questions to why their specific patients died in their care. Now, it's those M&M Monday morning meetings that form the crux of the personal and professional dilemmas that the doctors of Chelsea Journal face throughout the course of this book. For example, Dr. Wilson faces up to the implications when a young patient of his passes away during hazardous brain tumor surgery. Or, for example, Dr. Ridgway, who, while moonlighting at the public clinic, is beaten within an inch of her life outside that clinic where she does spend extra time outside the hospital. Now, Dr. Gupta writes Monday mornings with the feel of a typical episode of ER. It's given an episodic approach as each chapter smoothly shifts its focus from one character to another without breaking the reader's interest. And Dr. Gupta uses his skills as a medical journalist to great effect, as he deftly breaks down certain complicated surgical techniques that many of these characters utilize and the difficult medical situations, especially brain tumors and the type of treatments that can be employed, to the average reader that they can comprehend very easily without drowning in medical jargon. It's almost like a medical school lesson disguised as a novel. So Monday Mornings is an immensely readable novel that's a realistic portrayal of a contemporary hospital and the men and women in those white lab coats or green surgical scrubs who dedicate themselves and their skills, sometimes to the point of self-sacrifice, so they can possess the power of healing as many people as possible, no matter what it takes.
Wow. You know, it's interesting because I'm always looking for a good medical novel, mm-hmm. if not a medical thriller.
Right.
So it's interesting that here's yet another doctor, because there are quite a few doctors out there, as you alluded to earlier, who have written books.
Yes. So, I mean, there's Daniel Calla, who's a favorite of yours.
Daniel Calla is my favorite. Not shy to say that. He's written Pandemic, Resistance, Rage Therapy, Blood Lies, Cold Plague, and it's kind of hard to decide which ones I like best. Maybe Pandemic and Cold Plague are the top two I like of his medical thrillers.
And if you like medical thrillers, here's another author I recommend, Robin Cook.
Oh, yes, of course.
Yeah, who's written, I think, one of his pioneering work, Coma, back in 1977, which was also a movie, which starred John Viabujo, Michael Douglas, and a young Tom Selleck. And That was his classic medical thriller. And also, he published another terrific medical thriller 20 years later called Contagion, about contagious diseases in the time of AIDS, the AIDS epidemic as well. So he's another one I recommend very highly if you like your medical thrillers too.
By the way, I noticed how you mentioned a young Tom Selleck, like his age is that far apart from Jean-Vier Bougeot and Michael Douglas.
Well, back then, he was quite unknown. And in fact, he played a medical patient who ends up being a corpse. So he played two roles, so to speak, in that movie.
With or without mustache?
With the stash.
Okay. Excellent. So this book is?
It's called Monday Mornings by Dr. Sanjay Gupta of CNN fame, and it's published by Grand Central Publishing, and it's $27.99.
And you recommend it?
Yes, I do.
Excellent. And if I were to recommend how people could get in contact with you, how would they do that?
Well, funny you should mention that, Peter. My prescription, if you want a good book, is go read me every week in the West End Times, or if you can't read me in the paper, you could check me out online every week, www.westendtimes.ca.
Mm.
That's what the doctor ordered.
You want to call it?
Okay. Patient Dr. Holder, wanted an ER, stat.
Clear!
Boom!
Stuart Nelman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're in the home stretch of this edition of the Stuff File program. We have a few more Stuff File stories to get to before we get to our idiot of the day. You know, lots of people complete half marathons, just not too many do it in midair. But 47-year-old Australian runner Rob Ginnivan has done just that. He completed a 13.1-mile run on a small treadmill run by a generator in a basket of a hot air balloon over Canberra. No kidding. The high altitudes means he had to battle freezing weather, but the seasoned runner said the toughest part of the challenge was that he was able to take only small steps as space was restricted. Still, he made it and did it all to raise money for the Heart Foundation. Now, Rob said, What I didn't count on was that the basket actually tilted, so it was like running up a hill. Every time I took a step, the basket would sway from left to right, so I kind of had this C-type motion being in the air. It was quite bizarre and made it very difficult. Yeah, I'd like to know the thought process that went into this plan when he first hatched this one. Anyway, police officer Jason Rocco is in hot water and stands accused of breaking into his neighbor's home in Avalon, Pennsylvania, to apparently do some laundry. The homeowner contacted police after noticing his electric bill was unusually high, despite not having lived in the house for months. So he went to check out the house and found the dryer running. Inside, he found a load of clothes, including police and Marine Corps t-shirts. Investigators believe Rocco broke in through the back of the house and was using the washer and electric dryer regularly. But when questioned, he told police the door was already broken and he was just doing some laundry. Gee, where's a cop when you need one, huh? Oh, right, doing laundry in your house. And it would appear that going to the bathroom behind the Great Wall of China may not be so pleasant. But at least it's getting better, sort of. Officials in Beijing have set new cleanliness standards for public toilets, including a stipulation that they should contain no more than 2 flies. No kidding. The new rules, published by the Commission of City Administration, also set standards on odor and cover cleaning and training for attendants. The new rules also require signs in both Chinese and English to be installed in the toilets and regulate advertisements in public bathrooms saying they must not obstruct functionality and had to be legal. No word on exactly what the punishment would be if they find 3 flies in a toilet. And a woman in Boston's Chinatown claims that a trio of thieves hypnotized her into handing over $160,000. Even more amazing, the police are taking her quite seriously. The 57-year-old Cantonese speaker says 3 women stopped her on the street, did a little hocus-pocus hypnotizing, and sent her home with a bag to fill with money, passport, and jewelry. She later met up with them at Boston Common and handed over the goods. One local hypnotist said, "Having somebody instantaneously hypnotize you sounds a little unlikely, but similar reports have surfaced in New York, where they apparently go underreported because victims don't speak English or are too embarrassed. Such mesmerized muggings also fit in with Chinese lore. It's something that's potentially very dangerous," said a Chinese advocate in Boston. "I think the elderly are particularly vulnerable because they obviously would have a hard time just walking away." Okay, that's just weird on so many levels. And speaking of weird on so many levels, a man who impersonated his dead mother as part of a real estate scam using lipstick, manicured nails, and even an oxygen tank at a meeting was convicted of fraud and faces up to 83 years in prison. Thomas Parkin, age 51, was found guilty of 11 criminal counts, including charges of fraud, grand larceny, perjury, and forgery for his scams. Along with the real estate fraud, Parkin and a partner cashed his mother's Social Security checks every month for 6 years, stealing about $44,000. The real estate scam centered on an apartment building in the Park Slope section of Brooklyn that Parkin's mother, Irene Prushkin, had deeded to her son in the 1990s. In January of 2003, 9 months after his mother died, Parkin was forced to sell the building at a foreclosure auction. Soon after, Parkin and another man, Milton Romolo, age 49, filed a fraud lawsuit against the building's new owner under his dead mother's name. Parkin then doctored documents to make it appear that his mother was still alive and even set up a meeting with the Brooklyn District Attorney's Real Estate Fraud Unit to discuss the matter. At the meeting, investigators from the fraud unit found Parkin dressed as his 77-year-old mother, wearing a red cardigan, lipstick, manicured nails, and breathing through an oxygen tank. Parkin is due for sentencing at the end of May. Romolo, his partner in the fraud, previously pled guilty and was sentenced to 3 years in prison. Yes, Norman Bates lives. Okay, Cleveland is clearly not in a battle with Philly to become the city of brotherly love. John Davis was exiting off a freeway in Cleveland when he saw a homeless beggar on the exit ramp. So, feeling sorry for the man, he reached out from his car and handed him a couple of dollar bills. Davis says the man took the cash, but one of the dollars fell to the ground. The man bent over and picked it up, but just moments later, Davis found himself being pulled over by a cop who wrote him a ticket for littering. He now could have to pay up to $500, including court costs, but does plan to challenge the ticket in court. Cleveland police declined to comment, but Davis says it will make him think twice about helping those less fortunate in the future. Way to go, Cleveland. Way to go. Apparently, all other crimes in Cleveland must have been solved. Officials in Burnsville, Minnesota, have brought the full force of the law to bear on Mitch Faber, who was arrested, forced to pay a high bail, and released under electronic monitoring and only on the condition of drug testing. Now, what heinous crime did this man commit? Well, they have charged him with the crime of not putting proper siding on his house. According to a March report, Faber said he started re-siding, but when the economy turned bad in 2008, he stopped, assuming that the worst he would eventually suffer would be a fine. And it's nice to see that all crime in Burnsville, Minnesota has also been solved so that they can go after a guy about his aluminum siding. I was almost tempted to make officials in Burnsville, Minnesota the idiots of the day, but I did not, because up now is this week's Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This stuff file presents the Idiot of the Day.
They say revenge is a dish best served cold, but perhaps serving it up on YouTube is even better. And yes, I have put a link to this story up on the Stuff File page so you can actually see what I'm talking about. 25-year-old Chris Rochester had his camcorder stolen out of his boss's car in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Police eventually arrested the suspect and returned the camera to Rochester, who then came upon a most interesting video. The thief actually taped himself, showing his face, giving his name, and admitting to stealing the camera. So Rochester uploaded the little clip to YouTube. Yes. In the 79-second video, you see the suspect say, "This is my house. Yes, and a stolen camera that I stole. But it's okay, the cops won't figure it out." As he pans around the home and points out the kitchen and the bathroom, he later adds, "Oh yeah, to introduce you, my name is Hauka Yang. So yeah, how do you do?" Finally, he turns the camera to reveal his face and says with a smile, "And this is me. Hi." La Crosse Police Sergeant Randy Rank said he wasn't concerned that Rochester uploaded the video, even though Yang's case is still pending, noting, "It's his recorder. Those are his images on there. I don't see an issue with it." Okay, so why would someone record themselves basically confessing to theft on the very camcorder they stole, taunting the cops by saying they'll never get caught? One reason and one reason only. He's an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0145. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links and all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0145. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You could also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder, and don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. I'm your announcer, your name here. This is Ben Patrick Johnson. What am I being paid for this? What? You're flipping kidding me. Okay, that's it. Turn off the microphone.